Earlier today, the State Education Board gave the authority to Education Commissioner Jeff Riley to impose a universal mask mandate in Massachusetts schools through at least October 1st. It's anticipated that Riley will officially issue that mandate sometime this week, and it's a change from Governor Baker's earlier policy of leaving that decision to individual districts. It comes as the two-dose Pfizer vaccine got full FDA approval for people age 16 and up yesterday, and as COVID-19 hospitalizations statewide are nearing a four-month high. 139 people of those patients are in intensive care, highest number in more than 3 months. The positive test rate is slightly down at 2.5%. So, raises a lot of questions. What are yours? Whether it's about the Delta variant, vaccines, the virus in general, masking, call us. It is time for Ask the Doctors. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our doctors this week, Dr. Cassandra Pierre, acting hospital epidemiologist and an infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center, and Dr. Shira Durone, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Pierre, Dr. Durone, welcome back.
Great to be here.
Great to be back.
So I got a little tongue-tied there, but I feel like it's not inappropriate given the onslaught of information that's coming at us about COVID-19 and vaccines and boosters, et cetera. But I want to start with this latest piece of news expected this week, which is that Commissioner Riley will issue the masking mandate for all public K-12 students through October 1st. I want to note that middle and high schools will be allowed to lift the masking mandate after that if at least 80% of staff and students are vaccinated. So Dr. Pierre, what is your reaction to this move by the state?
I think it's a good move. I think it removes the burden of having to interpret data and think about what a particular school district will and won't tolerate, or specifically what parents will and won't have issues with. And it's based on science. We know that masking is part of a package of interventions that have been shown to be effective in limiting in-classroom transmission, even in communities in our country and other countries where COVID-19 transmission has been high. I do worry about the time frame. Of course, by October 1st, we'll be able to reevaluate, but we also worry that, similar to last year with the change in weather, people moving more indoors will have increases in COVID transmissions among adults and potentially school-age children. So I do think it's important to think about continuing indoor mask mandates beyond that point. Although we have stated that we want everyone to be vaccinated, including school-age children, we also do know that as a population level with our waning immunity to moderate and mild disease, waiting for a vaccination rate in a school environment that's higher might still leave the door open for some breakthrough infections as well. But overall, this is a really good move. Again, relieving the burden of having to make these decisions by the school boards themselves so that they can really focus on doing the work at hand to get kids ready for school.
Dr. Durone, I'm going to turn to you for your reactions. I do want to note, I misspoke. It's 2.6% positivity test rate here in the Commonwealth right now. I think I said 2.5. What is your reaction to this move by the state to impose a mask mandate in K-12 schools?
I think it's just right, too. And I think what this signals on the part of the commissioner and the board is that they take COVID-19 seriously, in particular, the danger that is associated with the Delta variant, but that they're also using data-driven metrics to think about what that off-ramp might look like. And, over the past few weeks, this issue has become so polarized with parents and educators and legislators on, with such strong feelings on either side of this issue. And this is really a way to bridge that gap. And I really have faith in the commissioner that over the next month plus until October 1st, additional data will be taken into account. And if there needs to be a change to that metric or that approach, that will happen.
So Dr. Pierre, you and Dr. Durone have sounded similar themes here. So then I do want to note that there are exceptions for students under 5 and students with certain medical conditions. What is the case for leaving students who fall under that exception unmasked, given what the two of you have just laid out?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, when we're looking at data-driven responses, there have been less information available to us about the efficacy of masks and the ability for children in that age range, the under five age range, to consistently wear them or wear them appropriately. I certainly, as a mother of 2 3-year-olds, feel like, you know, many children can wear them appropriately. But I think the larger concern might also be about development. So, and specifically social, emotional development, ability to understand cues. Many individuals have talked about the fact that masks can stunt those areas of development. And they've also been, on the other hand, some concern that, or not concern, but looking in literature and seeing that younger age ranges are less susceptible to infection, severe disease, and secondary transmission to other individuals. That being said, I do, you know, as with everything, there's always a trade-off in risks. And so while we worry about the emotional, mental health and development of our children, we have seen that COVID-19 can strike younger children as well. So I think it's really part of a risk calculation that has to be made. I do know that, you know, individual parents will still have the ability to consider masking for their children. And again, speaking as a mother to 2 3-year-olds, we are definitely masking consistently.
Okay, so let's pick up our first call, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Susan on the line in North Attleboro. Susan.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is about my son. He's 15. He's previously had COVID. So my husband and I are kind of not seeing eye to eye as to vaccinate or not vaccinate. My husband seems to feel that my son already has some natural immunity because he already has had COVID. So he does not want to vaccinate our son. And my question is, how many kids who have already had COVID are getting reinfected with COVID who have not been vaccinated?
All right, let's turn to Dr. Daron. Susan, thank you.
Great question. Yeah, so there is natural immunity from prior infection with COVID-19. Like vaccination, it's not perfect at preventing a subsequent episode of COVID-19. Like vaccination, people who do get infected after previously being infected generally have a milder course. What I can say is that when you add vaccination on top of natural immunity, it is more effective than natural immunity alone. But we shouldn't discount that natural immunity does provide some protection.
So this gives me an opportunity also, and Dr. Pierre, I'll ask you this, to raise the point. The caller's child is 15. Pfizer was approved by the FDA, fully approved. The Pfizer vaccine was yesterday. For people ages 16 and older. It is still under emergency use authorization for the younger ages. That intersection of how we know it's safe for one group of people and not another is a question that's come up a lot over the last few weeks. We've also heard a lot of questions about why we are recommending that pregnant women receive the vaccination while pregnant if we don't know that the vaccine is safe for little ones. So what can you tell us?
Yeah, no, that's a great point in terms of thinking about what contradictions might exist. So I think it's important to know here what an authorization versus an approval really gives you. We know we have evidence, we have really strong evidence about data regarding safety for both the 12 to 15 year age group, as well as for pregnant women. And we have a really strong track record of safety for the vaccines in these groups. What we haven't had and what we've been looking for in populations is enough extended data around efficacy for longer periods of time. And looking at the time out that we achieved from the trials, we now have for those older age groups, including for pregnant women, information about longer term efficacy than we did previously. And that, plus a number of other issues, in looking again at the efficacy of the vaccines after certain amounts of time have passed, has allowed the Pfizer vaccine in particular full approval. But we don't yet have sufficient time data out on efficacy, longer term efficacy for those younger age groups. Now, the safety considerations, we know what they are. Overwhelmingly, these vaccines are safe for all of the age groups that they have been authorized for.
And to clarify, Dr. Pierre, with that research and the data, in pregnant women, do we understand the impact on the baby?
Yes. So thank you for explicitly honing in on that. We do know that for pregnant women, and it's over 40,000 and counting at this point for whom we have data, we have not seen abnormal effects on the process of childbirth or on the fetus, on that baby. There's no difference in obstetric outcomes or neonatal outcomes from what we've seen, including for any harm to come to the baby in women who have received the vaccine versus women who have not in the general population. So we feel incredibly comfortable knowing, and CDC has also stated this, that these vaccines are overwhelmingly safe for pregnant women and their children.
Thank you for that. Well, I'm going to go back to the phones, 1-800-423-8255. We've got Chris on the line. Chris, I think you're in the car on Route 24, right?
Well, now I'm on 128.
Well, you're moving.
Oh, yes. Thank goodness. I want to thank you all for doing this, you know, daily. I'm wondering, all of my family, except for a couple of holdouts, have had the vaccine. And the reason they were giving, oh, it's experimental in their minds, that's what they believe, and even though I've seen plenty of data that led me to get them myself. But what can we do to get the message out? Because their next excuse, after now that it's been approved, was, yeah, but they didn't finish the triple-blind three-year study yet. So what can we do to assure people and put them at rest in some kind of media campaign to make it, you know, clear to people that this is not really experimental at this point? We've got plenty of data points.
Chris, thank you for that question. And Dr. Daron, it strikes me as Chris asks that question, the number of stories I have heard from people over the last couple of weeks about being in family gatherings where most people are vaccinated, but someone isn't, and the challenges that creates in the family dynamic as well. So what's your thought on Chris's question on messaging?
It is so hard. It is causing all kinds of rifts between friends and family members. Again, this is something that is polarizing people, that people feel so strongly on both sides of. And, you know, of course, those of us who believe strongly in vaccination believe it because it saves lives. And we don't want the people we love to get sick and have a bad outcome. You have to listen. You have to be compassionate. It's important to ask, what is it that's making you hesitant? And when you know exactly what the person's reasons are, then you can really address those specific issues. And often a person has learned or heard some specific thing that is misinformation or disinformation. And often we can provide the counter information based on data that show that whatever it is was not real, was not true. But we have to be compassionate, while at the same time increasing access for those who are still having difficulty getting it because they can't leave work or can't afford to have side effects and miss work. And at the same time, you know, it's really come to a point, unfortunately, where, you know, we have to implement those vaccine mandates. Employers, schools, universities are increasingly using those vaccine mandates, and ultimately that will save lives.
Do you agree with that, Dr. Pierre?
I could not agree more. I would actually say that I have a list of patients who I've spoken to over the past few months, and I kind of detail their reasons for not getting vaccinated. So I feel like I have a list of people who I'm like, oh, it's FDA approved. So it's a whole chunk of people I can call and make their appointment for. But I do know that for as many of those who have said that full approval has been the state that at which they will become vaccinated, that many of them will still have questions that they need addressed. And I'm fully prepared to do that. That being said, I do often acknowledge to others in my life that that they will be the most important person to speak to their family member, their colleague, their friend, more even so than me as an individual physician. I feel like we've been saying that throughout this pandemic, everyone's second job has been public health. So being able to listen, as Dr. Jerome lovely stated, it is going to be really important, and then engaging them on their specific concern or reason for hesitancy. But yes, I absolutely agree.
1-800-423-8255. We've got Rob on the line in Taunton. Rob, what's your question?
Yes. So I'm going on a family trip with our 16-month toddler. And what I'd like to know is, has airline travel been heavily impacted by the Delta variant? Are there more risks associated with traveling with a toddler during this time?
Thanks, Rob. Dr. Jerome, what do we know?
Well, I haven't seen any specific research papers that talk about airline travel in the era of the Delta variant. You know, what I know is that the success has been variable. Airplanes have really, really good air exchanges and filtration, but there's a lot of people in close contact, and you never know who's going to be right in front of you, behind you, or next to you. We know that the Delta variant is more contagious. It's less forgiving. If you have a super spreader on your flight that's infected with the Delta variant, you could have a lot of infections. You also could get lucky. That being said, travel can be very important for some people, especially those for whom family and close friends are an airplane ride away. And when people ask me if they should travel right now, I tell them to look at their own risk tolerance and how important that trip is. Children, especially the youngest children, tend to fare well when they do get COVID-19. So all of that has to be taken into account, and everybody has to make their own decisions.
All right, so Drs. Jerome and Pierre, our lines are full, and we are coming up against the clock. So I'd like to try to do a lightning round here and clear out a few more calls. We'll pick up Lisa in Acton. Lisa, go ahead.
Yes, in going to the gym, I'm wearing my mask, and I'm the only person in the gym that's wearing a mask. Is it effective in any way if I'm the only one doing that?
Dr. Pierre.
Yes, absolutely. Your mask will offer you protection to yourself. Please make sure that it is a good mask that is well fitted to your face, and do try to get some distance from others in the gym. Ensure there's good ventilation if you can. But yes, that mask will still offer you good protection.
And let's pick up Alicia in Hopkinton. Alicia, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Just with regards to the DESE ruling today, is there anything that's going to come down for those kids who are under 5, who are in pre-K, and half are masked and half are not?
Oh, I don't know if we know that, but Dr. Jerome, are you aware of anything?
No, I'm not aware of anything in the works on that.
Okay, let's go to Chris in Lincoln. Chris, go ahead.
Hi, I participated in the AstraZeneca trials back in January, and so I've been vaccinated for quite a while at this point. But with all the discussion of boosters and lack of information on AstraZeneca, I'm wondering if your guests had any thoughts on those few of us who do have AstraZeneca in the United States.
Dr. Pierre.
It's a great question. I think we've been looking for more direction for those who have participated in trials for vaccines that are not EUA approved through our FDA, including Novavax and AstraZeneca. We do have good evidence showing, good immunity or good boosting of immunity with mixing and matching vaccinations, but not necessarily for primary booster properties that we're talking about now. And so just like with Johnson & Johnson, we don't have any data at this point, and the CDC is not prepared to comment, at least not yet, on the boosting or the appropriateness of boosting with the mRNA vaccines for other kinds of vaccines. So we'll have to wait for information about that. And I'm sorry, I don't have more information for you.
All right, so then let's go to Nick in Jamaica Plain. Nick, you're on.
I am. I fall under the category of an immunocompromised patient, and I was wondering if the panel, the doctors, had any data or info regarding side effects, in particular from a third, like a booster.
Okay, Dr. Jerome.
Yeah, so far the data are very promising in terms of the third dose, and we don't call it a booster for people who are immunocompromised. We call it a third dose because it's really for people who haven't mounted a response, so they don't need a boost. They need an initial response. That side effect seems similar to those of the second dose. Now, part of that is that when you are immunocompromised, you don't mount a very vigorous immune response, and so you aren't expected to have a lot of side effects.
It was lovely of the two of you to do all that rapid fire. Thank you. With our little bit of time left, Dr. Pierre, I'll just pick up one more question that I have for you. Today, Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's the top infectious disease doctor in the country, essentially said that we might very well see, quote, a situation where the response goes way up and stays up for a long period of time, end quote, in talking about third shots, boosters. How can we know that now?
Well, I think that part of our knowledge is based on other priming that we've seen with other kinds of vaccine preventable diseases, seeing how vigorously we've responded, and also having a little bit of data at least on what other countries that have experiencing surges have seen after getting that booster, that is at least in the short-term data that we have, decreases in even mild, moderate disease. We may have, we, you know, and also, I
We're
should
almost
say,
out
also
of time,
some lab
just so
data.
You know.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, so also some lab data based on what we can see with antibodies and people who've been in clinical trials. We have some early indicators that there is a robust immune response with the third dose, but I really do think that data will be forthcoming. Time will tell.
Okay, you both were wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Cassandra Pierre of the Boston Medical Center, Dr. Shira Daron of Tufts Medical Center. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And listeners, we will do Ask the Doctors again next week. For now, that's our show. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.